I'm Indy Neidell, and this is another Great War podcast where we talk to cool people around the world that have stuff to do with the First World War. People from museums and universities and people that have written books and things like that. And today, I'm going to be talking to Aaron Pegram from the Australian War Memorial. Aaron, are you there?
I am indeed, and hello to you, and thank you very much for having me along.
No, this would be great. These are a lot of fun to do. So why don't you first just jump right in and tell us a bit about who you are and a bit about the memorial itself, and then we can get down to brass tacks.
Yeah, okay. Well, my name is Aaron Pegram, and I'm a historian at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, Australia, and I've been working there for about the last 10 years. I moved to Canberra in 2005 when I finished my undergraduate degree. I'd studied at Charles Sturt University in Wagga in New South Wales. I really had no sort of idea what I wanted to do or you know, what sort of career I was going to pursue. So I figured that I'd go off to university and study history because, you know, I was kind of interested in that sort of thing. I'd sort of bumbled my way through a degree and was fortunate enough to complete an honours year with first class honours, which sort of put me on the right path. I moved to Canberra figuring that if I was going to find a job working in history, I'd do it in the national capital here in Canberra. So I moved here in 2005 and I had an interest in military history. By that stage, I started reading a lot about the First World War. So I pretty much read everything that was associated with Australia in the First World War. Much of it was focused on Gallipoli, but my interest was on the very significant contribution to the Australians made to the fighting on the Western Front. And from there on, that led to a couple of jobs around Canberra, working in museums around town. And then finally, I got a job at the Australian War Memorial, a very low paying one as a curator working in our photograph section. But by that stage, I'd begun a part-time PhD. I just sort of grabbed the bulls by the horn and kind of went with it. So fast forward 10 years. I'm now working in the military history section where I work on everything from exhibitions through to books and publications. I lead battlefield tours to the Western Front once or twice every year.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a long haul. So that's not a weekly thing, I guess.
Let me assure you it is. I came back 2 weeks ago after 10 days in France and Belgium. I was leading a tour with 35 people for the centenary of the Australian action at the Battle of at Polygon Wood for the centenary in September this year, and it's taken me quite a while to actually get back into the routine of things. I'm what you call a public historian. I even though I have the academic credentials, I don't teach. I'm more often doing gallery tours in the memorials exhibition space. We're working on a publication called Wartime, which is the Australian War Memorial's quarterly magazine, and a few other things as well that keep me entertained. At the moment, I'm putting the final touches on a book on the Australians and the Victoria Cross. And biographies of each of the 100 Australians who had been awarded the Victoria Cross between from the Boer War through to the war in Afghanistan.
Well, that sounds very interesting. That sounds like a cool book.
Yeah, indeed. It's been quite interesting. I mean, to look at particularly the First World War entries. I mean, there's about 60 of them awarded to Australians in the First World War. But to actually have a look at those historical events through historical sources, Australians, it'd be fair to say that Australians know more about the First World War courtesy of the rich archival legacy of the First World War than what we do about, say, current conflicts, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Every Australian soldier who enlisted in the Australian Imperial Force has a service record that's been digitised and available through the National Archives of Australia. That's pretty close to 420,000 men, and each of those files can vary between 20 pages to 250. So, a rich archival resource relating to the First World War.
And who has access to those archives? Is it just you or people who are historians, or does the public have access to things? How does that work?
Yeah, no, it's all this material is available to members of the public. I mean, if you've got access to your smartphone and an internet connection, you can access that material from anywhere in the world. So not just individual service records, but also operational records relating to the Australian forces, war diaries that are just sort of administrative logs, daily entries that are kept by units whilst they're deployed overseas, engaged in the fighting. We're not just talking about those daily accounts. We're also talking about orders and after-action reports and maps and various other things, notifications that come down through the chain of command from general headquarters, right from the top, from Haig himself, all the way down to the lowly frontline soldiers. So, the idea being that by digitizing these records, we're preserving them, we don't have to access the original document and handle it and risk further deterioration. But it also increases the ability of the public, not just the Australian public, the international public, to access those records from the comfort of their home.
Well, that's interesting because I didn't realize that was all available, and I write this show, so I'm definitely going to be looking around there. I had no idea. So I've learned something today, and something I can actually take away and use for the remainder of the war. So thank you very much for that. It's funny, you and I have very similar historical background. I studied history at university and did honors and stuff, and I had no intention of teaching either, although it's kind of what I do now, but that's a byproduct. I mean, mine is a public historian, much like you.
Yeah, I kind of figured that if you enjoy, you just keep on doing what you enjoy doing, and you find someone crazy enough to pay you, you'll in the end, you'll just keep doing that for the rest of your life. And
that's the plan.
Yeah, absolutely. But I kind of enjoy the public history sphere, because you take what can be a very complex and very academic and dry subject matter, and you get to distill it down to its essential elements. And whether it be writing, the history of, a certain campaign on a 150 word object label for an exhibition display, or sort of distilling it down to its essential elements for a gallery talk or for a battlefield tour where your audience knows next to nothing about the First World War. So I think that's something that we perhaps have in common between what I do at the Memorial and what you guys do with the YouTube series and with this podcast.
Yeah, it's funny because you say, getting the specific number of words for this, right, or the little bites. I have, for a weekly episode, I have about 1,600 words to tell what happened that week, but also why it happened and what it meant, So that's fun. It's a challenge, because some weeks everything happened and some weeks far fewer things happened. I mean, there's always something to write about, but, that's probably my favorite part of the show is writing the show.
That's right. And I mean, if that 1,600 words then kind of, piques the interest in your audience members, and they then go off and read a book about the First World War, then that's mission success. That's what public historians do.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, the War Memorial itself, how old is it? I mean, what about the physical building, the actual, before we get down to more brass tacks? Could you tell us about the actual memorial?
Sure. Well, the Australian War Memorial, the building itself, has been there since 1941, and it's in the just as Australia was in the midst of the Second World War. It was initially a memorial to the Australians who fought in the First World War, and during that conflict, I mean, the Australians who had fought and died overseas, their families couldn't simply. They had to literally travel to the other end of the world to visit a gravesite. So most Australians who had lost sons, brothers, fathers, husbands during the First World War didn't actually get to see a gravesite. And a large number of Australia's 60,000 war dead remained missing. Such were the realities of fighting trench warfare, predominantly on the Western Front. So the War Memorial became something of a proxy site of commemoration, and certainly we sort of really get an essence of that during the opening in 1941. But of course, by then Australia's in the midst of the Second World War. They had Australian troops were then engaged in the fighting in the Middle East, And when the memorial opened, it was very obvious that it had to include objects and stories relating to those from in subsequent conflicts.
So when it was was it a government funded thing, a privately funded thing, or a combination, or how did that work?
That's a good question. I don't quite know the answer to it, but the initial sort of thinking behind the Australian War Memorial, it has its origins back in 1917. The Australian war correspondent Charles Bean was then with the Australians on the Western Front, and was witness to much of the fighting. He'd been on Gallipoli in 1915, was with the Australians all throughout the fighting on the Western Front until 1918, and then returned to Gallipoli in 1919 to try and work out what had happened. But he was also instrumental in creating what became known as the Australian War Records Section. So Bean was had the vision that perhaps the Australian contribution to the fighting would have to be remembered in Australia somehow, and this had this vision of this grand memorial that would both commemorate Australia's war dead and tell the generations of Australians whose men had served in the First World War what they'd actually done. So Bean sets about creating this section, which is tasked with creating all those rich archival records that we now have digitized and available on the website, as well as objects associated with the fighting. And these range from personal effects relating to Australian and other forces, as well as captured German guns and large technology items. I think the A7V Mephisto had been captured and brought back to the Australia with the intention of it returning to the Australian, going to the Australian War Memorial. But I know your views on Mephisto and the Australian connection. I don't think any reference to A7Vs either on the podcast or on your Instagram feed can go past without mention of the Australian contribution in capturing.
No, and we're going to see one actually in the German Tank Museum next month. They've rebuilt one, but it's not a real one. Well, it's a real one, but it's not a real one. They've rebuilt one, so.
Yeah. No, Mephisto was loaned to the memorial from the Queensland Museum just recently, and I was fortunate enough to actually climb inside and actually have a good look around inside. So that's from my lasting glory of being inside an A7V.
Now, we were in the Tank Museum Bovington over the summer, and I got to go inside like a Mark IV and stuff, and it was an amazing experience. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been to the Tank Museum in Bovington?
No, not to Bovington. I do want to though. It's one of the things that I definitely want to do next time I come to the UK.
It's pretty spectacular, actually. I mean, you think. It doesn't. I didn't think it was going to be as big as it actually was. You think, oh, tank museum, and then it's a tank museum. I mean, 300 tanks takes up a lot of space, and it's impressive. I'm really looking forward to the A7V thing because the A7V they have at the tank museum is not even a full metal replica, but it's just in storage there. Anyway, back to the memorial and stuff. I'm sure we could sidetrack about the war for the next 10 hours. How big is the war memorial? Because I haven't been there, and I only know it from the website, so I don't really have a physical thing. I mean, is this a small thing, or is it a big thing with hundreds of people that work there, or a couple of dozen, or you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, it's actually quite a large museum. The footprint of which I couldn't. Recite to you off the top of my head, but every day, well, we get about 1 million visitors to the museum or to the memorial every year. It's rated as the number one tourist attraction in Australia, and I believe it's within the top 15 in the world, I think. But as part of the Australian school curriculum, we have school children visit the memorial and go through our galleries. But what makes the Australian War Memorial unique and, say, distinct from the Imperial War Museum is that we have three main core purposes. Yes, we're a museum, and we tell the story of Australian military history through our galleries from the colonial period all the way through to the current conflicts, Iraq and Afghanistan. And, in fact, tonight there is a temporary exhibition opening on Australian Special Forces during those recent conflicts. We're an archive and a centre of learning. So school children will come and learn about the Australian military history, and members of the public are more than welcome to come and view original documents, operational records, letters, diaries, books by soldiers who had fought during that period. But of chief importance in binding all that, we're a memorial to the 106,000 Australians who have died on active service and in peacekeeping operations since the Boer War. And as I mentioned, 60,000 of them from the First World War. And in the commemorative space are listed, their names are on bronze cloisters in the memorial, flanking the main commemorative area, which lead up to the Tomb of the Unknown Australian Soldier, who in 1993 was brought back from Villers-Bretonneux in France, where he was killed fighting against German forces in April 1918. So we are quite a large institution physically, but we have a staff of about 280 people, predominantly those who work within the War Memorial Gallery space itself. I'm one of about six historians who work at the Australian War Memorial. So we seem to do a lot with a little, but it's a special place nonetheless.
Now, are you still as you said, like, you know, a decade ago, you were interested in war history and interested in World War One history? Is it still a bug for you? Does it still grab you to read about the First World War and learn about the First World War?
Absolutely. I mean, every day you cannot predict what's going to happen at every day. You know, when you work in a museum, you generally tend to think, oh, yeah, you know, that guy's, you know, dry and dusty and, you know, pretty boring. But, you know, we get to work on some really cool stuff that surprisingly comes up unexpectedly. I'm absolutely fascinated with the material I find in the operational war diaries from the First World War. To see, you know, the enthusiasm of a unit as it moves up the front line, as the guys, they're offered leave to the UK from the fighting on the Western Front, but they turn it down, knowing that the unit's going to be in action the next day, and then that unit will ultimately take heavy casualties in the engagement that follows. Or something so benign, such as disciplinary matters, which are referred to in the documents themselves. I find all that fascinating. But back to the whole notion of public history. I mean, within the context of the battlefield tours that I lead, I mean, members of the public, you know, they pay a lot of money to go to the other side of the world to have a look to study a patch of ground in France or Belgium, because that's exceptionally meaningful for them. That's where a father or a grandfather had fought during the First World War, or a relative had died. And so I take great pleasure in sort of being able to translate family stories or sort of bring to light something that's known within that family history and relate it to the First World War. I just got back from the Western Front with a group of 35 people for the centenary of the Battle of Polygon Wood. Yeah. And, you know, I had people on that tour whose fathers fought in the First World War and had told them stories about what the fighting was like. And it was amazing to actually be standing, say, on the Menin Road and leading up to the forward area and point out this is where he was, this is what he was doing. And that story that he had told you of the shell fire, of the ambulance wagons being led back to Ypres and German shells falling all around them, that happened right here. It's quite a moving and touching experience.
You know, next year we're tentatively planning on doing some filming in Flanders and stuff. It'd be interesting if we could time it so we were there the same time as you, actually, so we could get you on camera, because that'd be cool. So we'll talk about that over the next 6 months or so. But that's just an idea. Going on the road, if we're both in the neighborhood, then we should definitely, you know, do a...
Absolutely, yeah. Well, of course, I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't advocating for you guys to come out to Australia.
So I'd like to. I'd really like to see. I'd like to go down to that neck of the woods. I want to go to Guam to see the stuff there. We did a special episode about Guam during the First World War, and the reason we were inspired to do it was actually the Guam Tourist Board got hold of us and said, you know, Guam, a lot of stuff happened in Guam on Guam in the First World War, which I was unaware of, and I'm, you know, supposed to be a First World War scholar. But it was very interesting. So if we're going to go to Guam, we got to go to Australia, of course, you know, so that'd be great.
Well, absolutely. You get to see how the First World War has a long-lasting impact in Australian society because, you know, all the small country towns that are all throughout Australia, all these country towns have a memorial to the men from that local community who enlisted, fought and died in the First World War. I think that would be an interesting perspective. But also, Australian forces, I mean, when we generally think of the Australians and the Anzacs and the First World War, we generally think of Gallipoli. But the first action fought by Australian forces in the First World War is in German New Guinea in September 1914. New Guinea is a German colony directly to Australia's north. And the first campaign conducted by Australian forces is against the German naval reservists holding the wireless station and in the Southwest Pacific. And in September 1914, the Australian forces, we didn't actually have an army we could send overseas, so we sort of cobbled together this military force that's referred to as the Australian Naval and Military Expeditionary Force. It's quite a mouthful. And mainly naval reservists and militiamen who had signed on exclusively for this specific campaign. And they land up off Rabaul. And that's where the first action involving Australians in the First World War takes place. There's a small skirmish between Australian naval reservists and German reservists and Melanesia at a place called Bitapaka. And what the Australians are trying to do is knock out a wireless station that's about 7 kilometres inland. And that wireless station is communicating to the German East Asia Pacific Squadron, which is floating about in the Pacific waters around Australia, just as Australia's trying to raise enough troops to send overseas to the war in Europe. But they get waylaid and get sent to Egypt instead. So, that's kind of interesting. I mean, most Australians probably don't even know that, let alone some of your listeners.
It's funny to talk about timing. And I wasn't certain if it was August or September, but in September, we actually filmed a special episode about just the South Pacific War, about exactly what you just talked about. It's going to come out in like 3 or 4 weeks, he says. Well, brilliant minds think alike. Here's a question that I don't know the answer to, and I'm sure you do and stuff. When the Australians went to war, did they also, like they had in Britain, have PALS battalions at first?
The short answer is no, they didn't. What happens is at the outset of the First World War, the Australian government agrees to send an initial contingent of 20,000 troops to serve at Britain's behest. Okay. And we don't have an army that can serve overseas. Australia federated in 1901, and at that moment we had a small permanent army, but it's for home defence. And we have a citizens' military force, sort of reservists, all throughout the country, but they too are for home defence only. So the Australians sort of set about the Australian government then forms what's referred to as the Australian Imperial Force, which is ostensibly part of the British forces, but with a distinctly Australian flavour, and it's raised all throughout Australia. We don't actually have that sort of PALS battalion makeup within the AIF, but there are certain units, brigades, and formations, other formations that have a distinctly state-based recruiting. I mean, the 10th Battalion, for example, was raised in Western Australia. Most of the 1st Brigade was raised in New South Wales from the suburbs of Sydney. I think that was more due to the realities of the recruiting depots, the establishment of the recruiting depots in Australia. I mean, not everybody or not all of the volunteers that enlisted for the AIF went to the same recruiting depot. I mean, there were training camps in Perth in Western Australia on the other side of Australia, Brisbane in Queensland. There are several depots in Sydney. And once recruiting for the AIF peaks in mid-1915 during the Gallipoli campaign, I mean, all the Australian casualties that are suffered on Gallipoli does very little to sort of deter recruiting. In fact, it stimulates it. these training camps get overloaded, particularly in New South Wales, and then you have a whole bunch of regional areas that start up recruiting or training camps. So then you do have quite by accident, you have these little sort of this short period where what they refer to as the snowball marches. These are a series of these are patriotic marches that start in a small rural country town in the middle of nowhere in Australia. And a group of guys who just decide they want to enlist together, they start walking to the nearest recruiting depot, and the size of the group snowballs as it goes along. And there's a number of these throughout Australia. They're highly celebrated at the time and reported. And the guys who enlist, you know, these guys are sort of revered or celebrated as local heroes, which inadvertently puts a lot of pressure on men within the community who hadn't enlisted. And then so when these guys go through training and they actually get to a battalion, you do actually have that PALS battalion makeup, which I think is kind of interesting. I mean, the 55th Battalion, for example, which goes into action at Polygon Wood in September 1917, is predominantly made up of men from the Snowy River area in southern New South Wales. So just by fluke, you know, that we do actually have some of that happening within the AIA.
But not intentionally. That's very interesting. Now that we've talked about the men, how about the men that might have been left behind? Why don't we talk about what you wrote about the actual prisoners themselves?
So as I mentioned, I started my PhD about 10 years ago, and because I work a full-time job, I started and stopped and started and stopped, and I've recently submitted. So, you know, pleased to say that that's in. But I was kind of struck by... In Australia, when we think about prisoners of war, it's predominantly a narrative associated with the Second World War. About 26,000 Australians were captured in the Second World War, most of whom in the Pacific by the Japanese. And those guys had a particularly horrible experience, so much so that when Australians generally tend to think about captivity, it's associated with those horrible, nasty experiences of suffering at the hands of the Japanese. I was starting to look at, captivity in the First World War, because you didn't really hear too much about it. And there are about 4,000 Australians who were captured during the First World War, around 200 by the Ottomans in the Dardanelles, in Mesopotamia, and in the campaign in Sinai and Palestine. And a lot had been written about them, mainly because of a similarity between their experiences and those of the Australian prisoners of the Japanese in the conflict that followed. But there was next to nothing on the 3,848 Australians who were captured by the Germans on the Western Front. And this got me thinking, well, you know, what's the difference? I mean, that's clearly the larger dominant group. Very surprised to find that nearly all of them, around 320 of them, survived the First World War and returned home. So I thought that was kind of interesting, an interesting little sort of peak. I mean, these Australians who had been captured in the most sort of violent sort of turmoil of combat on the Western Front, they get captured by German forces, and they spend the rest of the war in Germany, and nearly all of them survive. I think that's actually quite remarkable. And then when I broke down the statistics when I did a mortality study, I found that virtually all of these guys who die in German captivity do so from the wounds where they receive in action. So on the surface, it kind of looked like captivity may have actually spared these men from death or wounding in the fighting on the Western Front. So I set about looking at how and why, looking at survival in German captivity during the First World War. I started poking around in the archives and found this exceptionally rich collection of statements by returned prisoners of war. When Australians coming back from Germany and from the Ottoman Empire were repatriated back to England or back to Egypt, they had to sit down and sort of give a formal statement on how they were captured and how they were treated by their captors. And of the 3,848 Australians captured on the Western Front, close to 3,000 of them gave written statements on their on the nature of their experiences. So needless to say, I was actually quite surprised to find these documents, which it was quite important to my study, and in all reality, it was about 50 to 75 meters away from where from my desk at work. So I was actually quite fortunate in that. But I wanted to not just look at the experiences of prisoners, because I also wanted to sort of bring in a German narrative as well. There had been some studies by historians in Europe on the German treatment of Allied prisoners during the First World War. But I was really interested in sort of what sort of benefits prisoners were to the German army, and particularly looking at the intelligence value of Australians captured by the Germans on the Western Front. I mean, one of the reasons why armies take prisoners is for intelligence gathering, and it's certainly prisoners of war an important source of news in the fighting on the Western Front. So So what I did was identified a whole series of German records in the Kriegsarchiv in Munich, and then also in the Hauptstaatsarchiv in Stuttgart, and I found intelligence reports based on the interrogation of Australian prisoners. So looking at captivity from the German perspective and looking at what the Germans learned from the capture of Australian prisoners. What I found was quite startling. The Australians, as with the British, rest of the British Army at that time, didn't have any counterintelligence training, which meant that that men who were likely to go into action weren't actually told or trained on what was expected of them if they had the misfortune of falling into enemy hands. So in the First World War, it was not an officer's duty to try and escape. And you were to say the only sort of directions were that you were to only give your name and rank, although that message wasn't particularly pressed home until after the Somme campaign. So what I found was in the German records that when Australians were captured by German forces, they sang like canaries. They talked about the movements of the Australian forces since their arrival on the Western Front. They talked about the strength and disposition of the Australian defences in a particular sector. They talked about the outcome of the two conscription referenda held in Australia. They complained about their conditions. They complained about their officers. And all this kind of fed into this huge, big intelligence gathering machine, behind German lines. And the Germans were able to build up what they referred to as mood pictures of what was happening behind British lines. But of course, the most valuable information the Germans were able to acquire from them were non-verbal. I mean, the Australians wore on their uniform regimental titles, colour patches, which all sort of indicated different movements of British units up and down the length of the Western Front. And so what the Germans were monitoring was where certain divisions were at any given time, so they can then prepare for a likely offensive, and that's usually what happened. But there's a couple of cases I actually came across, two Australian soldiers who willingly deserted to the Germans. One of whom was a German Australian, and he had no problems with going to Gallipoli and shooting at the Ottomans, but took quite an issue to being sent to France, where he was shooting at his German cousins. Things were not particularly well for him. I think he was a bit of an outcast from within his platoon. He had an injury which kept on nagging at him, and in his repeated protests and attempts at trying to get a base job were constantly rejected. So while the Australians were in the relatively quiet sector around Armentières, he just simply left his post and toddled off over to the Germans. He told them he actually was quite candid in his information and in sort of disclosing information to the Bavarians opposite. And I don't know whether or not he was trying to curry favour with them, but he was telling them all about the strength and disposition of the Australian forces, the location of gun and battery lines. And he also warned them that a major offensive was coming in the following weeks, and that, of course, in the following months, was the Third Battle of Ypres.
Now, but this guy, I mean, what happened to him once he was taken by the Germans? I mean, did he end up in a POW camp, or what happened? Okay, and then you got him back after the war. Australia got him back. So did he serve a sentence as a traitor, or how did that, what happened to him? Yeah.
What's interesting is, there is desertion within the Australian and British forces, desertion to the enemy. I mean, desertion behind your own lines is a wholly different kettle of fish. But
then desertion in the face of the enemy.
Correct. Right? Yeah, correct. But sure. Australians are held accountable under British military law during the First World War, and desertion to the enemy is a capital sentence. I mean, that's a punishment faced with you if you're caught and you're found guilty of it. You face a firing squad. But what happens with the Australians? They're a unique case. There is a certain clause in the Australian Defence Act which says that Australian troops cannot be executed without the approval of the Australian Governor General. That is the King's man in Australia. And as a result of that, there are no Australians formally executed under British military law during the First World War. What happens to this guy? He heads off over the German lines. He curries favour with them by giving them information. The German intelligence officers are very wary of what he is saying. They're actually quite sceptical that perhaps the British were trying to feed misinformation to disrupt German plans. And then so his statements, which make for some pretty bold reading, are swiftly ignored. He enters a prisoner of war camp where he's ostensibly ostracized by the other prisoners of war. And he has a quite a difficult time in captivity. He survives the war, returns back to Britain, where he has to account for his crime. There had been a court of inquiry in the meantime, which had determined that he had indeed deserted to the Germans. He's arrested. He spends some time held at Warwick Square, the military prison in London. Desertion to the enemies is one of four crimes Australian troops could be executed for under British military law. His sentence is commuted. He has developed what's referred to on his service record as mental trouble. And then I don't know whether or not it's because the war has reached its end, but he's put on a troop ship home, sent home to Australia, discharged, and not given any sort of repatriation benefits following the First World War. So he kind of fades into obscurity thereafter.
Yeah, I guess he wouldn't advertise his actions, you know, once back in Australia after the war.
No, I traced him through Ancestry, and I found that through census records, he lived a fairly solitary life for the remainder of his years. He lived at Perth in Western Australia, and I think he was a gardener up until about the mid 1950s and 1960s, and then he kind of drops off away. You know, he just fades from the historical record. So, I mean, it's a sad story. I mean, he's a man who's just. His bottle was full, and you know, he did what he thought was the best thing to him, available to him. It may not have been the right thing when we have a look at it, the benefit of hindsight, but of course. It sort of alters the course of his life and affects him through the rest of his years.
Can you talk a little bit about what the conditions were like for the POWs, particularly once you had like the turnip winter when half of Germany was starving and stuff? How that affected things?
So I think it's probably just to give an overview. I mean, the captivity in the First World War sort of it laid out these unprecedented challenges among the belligerents between France, Britain, and Germany. They'd never experienced captivity on this scale before, and in many respects, captivity in the First World War then goes on to determine how prisoners of war are then treated in the Second World War. Germany had largely prepared for a very short war of mobility. Much of its domestic wartime economy, or its wartime economy, was geared towards production of war material and fighting a war on a single front, not one on multiple fronts. And that really sort of comes at the expense of the domestic situation at home as well. I mean, so much, there's so much emphasis on the military and the conducting of these campaigns. The needs of the civilians is sort of dropped by the wayside. What happens is that Germany is successful initially in the fighting in 1914. And by October 1914, Germany has 185,000 Allied prisoners in its care. All these French, Russian, British prisoners are flooding into Germany, where they're held into these sort of hastily erected, poorly equipped and underprepared prisoner of war camps, which completely flooded with prisoners. They have little food. The barracks are disease-ridden and filthy. And of course, this ultimately leads to an outbreak of typhus. Russians fighting in the Eastern Front, who had brought with them typhus, which ravished the British and the French. And conditions in Germany during that first winter of 1914-1915 are pretty horrible. But things had changed significantly before the first Australians are captured on the Western Front and entered Germany. What had happened was the German prison system underwent a major restoration. I mean, this sort of activity of prisoners dying from malnutrition and disease was not a good thing, and in fact, it violated the terms of the 1907 Hague Convention. So Germany goes about and then tries to re-engineer the prisoner of war system. There's about 175 prison camps that are ultimately established throughout Germany, both for distinctly for officers and then also for other ranks, in accord with the Hague Convention. There's still thousands of prisoners flooding into Germany, 1.6 million by August 1916. By then, the Royal Navy had started blockading the German ports and preventing vital foodstuffs and fertilizers from entering Germany. So Germany itself is charged not only just with feeding and sustaining its own people, but also these millions of prisoners of war. So one of the ways the Germans look at solving this issue was to take a look at that large, very large body of other ranks prisoners who, under military law could be worked, and send them out into the far-flung regions of Germany with sentries to work and sustain the domestic economy. So you have millions of prisoners engaged in agriculture, in the production of steel, in mines, all throughout Germany, while the officers, they're protected under international law and don't have to work. And in fact, the Germans pay them their equivalent pay within the German forces. On top of all this, the food situation in Germany then becomes quite dire, as you mentioned, the turnip winter of 1915-1916. But one of the ways in which Germany can sort of defray the cost of feeding these millions of prisoners is allowing them relief by international aid agencies such as the Red Cross. The Russians didn't, as far as I'm aware, the Russians didn't weren't receiving food and welfare from home, nor did the Italians. I think in the Italians' case, that may have actually served as an incentive for men to be willingly giving themselves up. Also, the government at the time had thought. I think Russia was under the impression that by sending food and clothing to prisoners of war in Germany, maybe actually assisting Germany materially. But for the British and the French, including the Australians, they received regular consignments of food and clothing from their respective national Red Cross agencies. And the Australians who arrive in Germany, probably about 3 months after capture, they start receiving Red Cross food parcels. And so while the Germans outside or beyond the wire are working, they slowly begin to starve and undergo these critical food shortages throughout the course of the war, which gets worse and worse as the war progresses. Australian prisoners in contact with the Red Cross are receiving tinned meat. They're receiving, teas, boiled chicken. They're receiving cigarettes. They receive soap. It'd be fair to say that some of the Australians who endure captivity in Germany become some of the best fed people in the country, and that goes way in sustaining them throughout captivity. And some of the interesting stuff that I've come across in my thesis is that the other ranks working out in the countryside were also receiving their Red Cross food parcels, and they're able to exchange the contents from their food, Red Cross food parcels for commodities, whether it be for escape equipment, wire cutters or a compass, or it could be just for additional firewood for a cold night. But there are men who are receiving parcels who are actually you have German women and women from the Balkan states who are working in Germany offering their bodies in exchange for soap. Such are the dire economical situation in Germany. So yeah.
But what would the guards and I guess the locals think? If you're starving or the guards obviously have better food than maybe the locals during the turnip winter. But would there be a lot of resentment, or would there be hatred, or would it be how can I get my hands on that? How was the reactions to these guys getting food and care packages?
Despite Germany's dire economic situation, I think it's actually quite remarkable that the Red Cross food parcels in the main made it to their intended recipients. There's a whole sort of principle of reciprocity going on in Germany at the time, because if parcels don't end up arriving with prisoners, the prisoners then start complaining to the Red Cross and then their own home government, who in turn have tens of thousands of German prisoners. So there is what's referred to as this principle of reciprocity. So the fear of German prisoners being denied food and mail, ultimately affects the German treatment of Allied prisoners. But as far as guards and their opinions go, guards are part of this black market trade and racketeering. Guards are willingly, offering prisoners escape equipment in exchange for cigarettes or tinned meat to feed families at home. In fact, there's a famous account of an Australian orderly at the officers' camp at Holzminden. He is a photographer in civilian life, and he procures enough material, enough photographic equipment on the black market at Holzminden through the guards, that he's able to make 300 copies of a map of Germany to use in the mass escape attempt at Holzminden in July 1918. 300 copies. Yeah, it is amazing. So, prisoners of war, yeah, they may be living behind barbed wire, but they actually have quite a lot of agency to shape the conditions that surround them.
Well, this is really fascinating, and you've written a book about this, yes? And when will that be coming out?
Well, I've written a PhD thesis on Australian prisoners captured on the Western Front, which once I hear back from my examiners, I'll be able to work on their comments, and hopefully once my PhD passes, I'll be able to turn my attention to writing a book. So what I'm hoping to do is have a book out at least late 2018, which I think is a fitting time to look at the experiences of prisoners of war, because they do fall out.
Spoilers. No.
Yeah. They all lived happily ever after. Or did they?
that's got to be my last line of the show. And they all lived happily ever after.
Pretty much. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh yeah. When is the book about the VC recipients coming out?
Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned earlier that I'm currently working on a book on the 100 Australians who were awarded the Victoria Cross between the Boer War and Afghanistan, and that goes off to the publisher on the 1st of November. And I'm hoping, with any luck, it'll be out in August 2018. So stay tuned for that one.
Yeah, and everybody, since you have an interesting name, Aaron Pegram is a very interesting name. So everybody will be able to remember it, and they'll be able to look it up next August, the next September, to find the book, and so they can learn more about all of the individual Australian VC winners, right?
Correct. That's right.
Okay. Well, Aaron, it was great having you today. That was fascinating. This is going to be a really, really good episode. And particularly that I always like ones when I actually learn stuff that I didn't know and stuff that I can use in the show.
Oh, cool.
And I'm definitely going to check out the digitized stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah, well, if you need a hand or if you need like some good material for the show, you know, I've got some cherished favorites, or, you know, just fling me a line. I'm more than happy to help you guys out.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Aaron. And Flo, thank you for sitting here and silently nodding your head and saying, oh, that's interesting. And this will come out soon so everybody in the world can listen to this. And hopefully we will see you next year, assuming we're on the Western Front at the same time, right?
Absolutely. I'm going to be in France and Belgium in July next year, in 2018, and I'll be there for about a month. So I'm hoping that perhaps that may cross over with you guys, because I'm a big fan of the YouTube channel. I really enjoyed your inaugural YouTube or the podcast. It'd be really good to meet you guys in person and share history with you.
Well, Flo just gave the high sign, so apparently July is perfect for us. So he's in charge of logistics.
Let's make it happen.
Well, and say goodbye to all your fans out there in podcast land.
See you later, guys. Thank you very much for listening.